We have a wonderful panel for you again. On this panel today, we have Omar Freya, who is the founder and coordinator of the Green Worker Cooperatives, which is an incubator of the worker-owned, eco-friendly businesses. One of his focuses is upon creating jobs that promote life instead of taking it away. We also have Steve Dunn here, and I'm not doing this in order. Steve is the research director. Raise your hand, Steve. Raise your hand, Steve. Thank you. Omar, raise your hand. Thank you. Steve is the research director of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and has worked there since 2004. He also conducted with Ted Howard the initial strategic planning that led to the development of the Evergreen Cooperative Initiative in Cleveland, Ohio, and currently assists efforts to adopt that model to meet the needs of other cities. Steve, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you. Thank you, Brooke. We also have Michael Peck. Michael has served for well over a decade as the North American delegate for Mondragon. In 2009, he participated in forming the Mondragon and United Sheet Workers Union partnership to create union co-op hybrids. We also have with us the wonderful Michael Ricky McLean, who is going to raise his hand right now.
Okay.
Michael is from the new era windows and doors. Now, right before December of 2008, holidays, with the economy plunging into crisis, 300 plus workers at the Republic Windows and Doors factory learned that they were about to lose their jobs in Illinois. No, that's not the clap. The clap is that those 300 workers, when they understood that they were about to lose all pay coming to them, vacation and whatever else pay, and the health insurance was immediately going to be stopped, they took it over. That's the clap. They occupied the factory in protest, and after a roller coaster ride, New Era was formed. Then we have also the illustrious Saladin Muhammad. And forgive me for not introducing you others as illustrious or famous or fantastic, because you are just as well. Saladin is from the Black Workers Justice and is a retired organizer of the Southern Workers Assembly, founder of the Southern Workers Assembly. And last but not least, we have Mary B. McMillan. And she doesn't have to raise her hand because she's the only woman we have today. Mary B. is the Secretary Treasurer of the North Carolina AFL-CIO, which is the largest federation of trade unions in the United States. Thank you.
Hey, good afternoon, Jackson. Good afternoon. Not sure how well this, it sounds like it's working. Can you hear back? All right. So my name is Steve Dove, and I'm the research director at the Democracy Collaborative. And this panel is on community wealth, cooperatives, and economic democracy, worker democracy. And so I wanted to make a few observations and hopefully, you know, help spur some discussion in the sessions this afternoon and tomorrow. So, you know, I think one thing we have to look at is the context in which we are operating. And, you know, this is, I was saying to a colleague this morning, you know, we're in kind of Dickensian times. So this is the best of times for co-ops and co-op development, but it's also the worst of times for our society and our economy, And it's important to keep both facts in mind. So one statistic that I think is telling is that the top 400 people, you could actually, there might be 400 people in this room, the top 400 wealthiest individuals, according to Forbes magazine in this country, have more wealth than 180 million people in the United States combined, that 3/5 of the population. So the top 400 back in 2011 had 1.27 trillion in wealth, and the bottom 180 million had a net worth of 1.21 trillion. Just to take that forward 2 years, that 1.27 trillion is now 2.02 trillion. So that's a $750 billion increase for 400 people, $1.75 billion per person. Another way of thinking about it, a third of the wealth of the top 400 individuals was accumulated in the last 2 years. So there's a real theft of wealth going on in the United States. And the work we're doing here, the work you're doing in Jackson, from wherever all of you are coming from to Jackson, you know, is in response to that. And the approach that we developed at the Democracy Collaborative, we call it community wealth building, and it's one tactic for taking our economy back. Just like the folks at New Era Windows took their piece of the economy back. So, few principles. The key is to start with values, define what we believe in. You know, the ecology, equal, equity, social responsibility. Develop productive assets in our community. Grow businesses based on that. So it's business, but business for a social purpose. And another factor that's critical is ownership. So creating an economy, the only way we're going to change those wealth numbers I cited at the beginning is if we change who owns productive capital. And cooperatives and other forms of what we call community wealth building, forms of business that are owned and responsive to people in low-income communities, that's what's going to take to start to move those numbers. A few observations and ways to do this work, there'll be sessions later where we can talk about these in a more dialogical way, but just a few thoughts. One is that hard times create new opportunities for development. So I'm not going to talk a lot about the Evergreen Cooperatives and our work in Cleveland, but what I will say is it relied on very unusual partners. If you had told somebody 10 years ago that a foundation, a community foundation, was going to support worker cooperative development in low-income communities, they would justifiably call you crazy. And yet it happened. And it hasn't just happened in Cleveland, but it's happening in other communities, in Atlanta, in Washington, D.C., in Amarillo, Texas. We had a forum just this last, in the end of March, sponsored by the mayor of Jacksonville, Florida. So these are not blue state territory necessarily. Amarillo prides itself on voting for Goldwater, even though LBJ was from their home state. And yet they find something of appeal in this community wealth building model. Hospitals, universities, those are also unlikely partners, and yet they are the purchasers of the business, of the goods and services that we've developed. And the hard times create a new incentive for these publicly subsidized institutions. We should never forget that. Hospitals and universities are publicly subsidized institutions. They have a new opportunity they have new incentives, basically, to reinvest in their communities, and that provides the opportunity for unusual alliances. So that's one thought. A second thought is we have to be flexible. In Cleveland, we developed what are known as multi-stakeholder cooperatives. So the cooperatives are owned 80% by the workers and 20% by a nonprofit. In Washington, D.C., they're developing an employee-owned company but it will be done through a C corp. So it'll be privately, it'll be a private corporation, but with the workers owning the majority of the shares. So the techniques that are used are going to be different in different communities. The laws are different in different states. You have to be creative and you have to be flexible. A third point is you need to pay attention to education, to training, and to culture. And this has been a challenge for us with Evergreen. It's a challenge for the cooperative movement. You go to a lot of cooperative conferences, and it's mostly people who look like me. It's mostly a white movement still. And the majority of the United States will soon be people of color. Certainly the majority of people being born in the United States are already people of color. And bridging that cultural divide, having systems of education and training in place, being aware and cognizant of those differences is hugely important to making this work happen. Another point is that we need to be building the skills of our movement. We need skills to do business, to do business development, to do finance, to do workforce and education training. And lastly, I want to conclude by the fact that we need to build institutions. So on this panel, we have somebody from the AFL-CIO, and it's important to note, and I used to work in labor myself, Michael Peck works a lot with labor. It's important to note that labor unions used to be an important countervailing institution to prevent those kind of wealth numbers that we discussed. You know, it used to be the top 1% had 8% of income, now they have 20%. That's because unions have gotten so weak. Unions that in the private sector used to be 35% of the workforce in the 50s are now 7% in the private sector. And co-ops and other are an institution that, combined with a revived labor movement, can start building the political power and the economic power necessary to shift that structure over time. So it's not just building our own businesses that's important, it's building the support network, and it's keeping our eyes on that larger prize, which is, you know, creating institutions that are community responsive and displacing the power of corporate capital. So I'll conclude there, and thanks very much for your attention.
My name is Omar Freya, and I'm from New York in the Bronx, and I founded and coordinated an organization called Green Worker Cooperatives. And what we're about is really creating the opportunity for cooperatives, worker cooperative development in communities that have been left out of the process for a long time. But first, I want to bring a point of clarification and attention to something. How many people, just by a show of hands, raise your hands if you think that worker cooperatives are primarily involve white people? Okay, let me say this another way. Raise your hands if you think that most people, or at least half of people in worker cooperatives, are people of color. Okay, so the honesty comes out. All right, raise your hands if you think that most people in worker cooperatives are women. The owners of businesses are women. Okay, a few more people. So it looks like most people here think that the owners of businesses, the owners of worker cooperatives, are primarily white men. Is that true? Okay, well, y'all think that because most hands didn't go up. So I want to point out something. There are about 400 or so worker cooperatives in the United States. So it's not much. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the larger economy, traditional businesses. So they're not a whole lot of people. But we do know that I would say maybe half, or slightly less than half or so, of the members of worker cooperatives are actually people of color. And about maybe a good number, I'd say more of those, are women. Yes, more are actually women. So worker cooperatives as a movement, you know, is actually a movement that is primarily women of color. Now, you wouldn't know that from just the talk of worker cooperatives and what's out there. You wouldn't necessarily know it from going to worker cooperative conferences, and unfortunately, you wouldn't necessarily know it from looking at the panel that's up here. But it is a fact. And so it's something that for all of us who are part of the cooperative movement, we have to take into account when we're talking about, you know, who's going to be representing the co-ops, you know, who's going to be at panels, who's going to be representing, and what kind of a message is put out there. So it's just, it's something that we have to keep in mind. I got into the movement of worker cooperatives about 10 years ago because I saw in it a promise for really transforming the community that I come from, and that community is the South Bronx. And it is an area that has been on the margins of New York City and the rest of the country, and it's an area that is, you know, at the bottom of the barrel in New York City, and at the top of all of the wrong statistics and all of the wrong indices. And so really creating a structure that can transform that was central to me and central to us at Green Worker Cooperatives. And all of the folks that I've run into over the years that come from communities like Detroit or Austin, or in parts of Massachusetts or in Richmond, California, who see the promise of worker cooperatives as really keeping money in the community and really empowering people so that people can be owners of the enterprise collectively as worker cooperatives. Now I want another question. How many people here are part of a worker cooperative? By a show of hands. Okay, you can put your hands down. How many people here are inspired by worker cooperatives and want to help create worker cooperatives? All right. And how many of you are not part of a worker cooperative but want to create a worker cooperative yourselves? Nice. Now, how many of you had no connection to worker cooperatives before but came because you've just been a part of the movement for social justice, and there was something about Brother Chukwe Lumumba, something about this call for this conference that attracted you, that you saw a promise in? Okay, excellent. So for all of you, well, for everybody, but particularly for those of you in the last group and those of you who want to help create cooperatives, I want to share with you just about probably 2 minutes or 1 minute of what's left of my time for our experience. There are lots of different ways to creating cooperatives and creating worker cooperatives. And there's some great, excellent models, all of them people really working hard to create worker cooperatives. The work that's been done in Evergreen is a great example. The work that's been done by groups like Wages and other groups to really incubate and take their own idea and bring people on to create it is something that's powerful. We've taken a different approach at Green Worker Cooperatives that's rooted and that's come out of work that we've done, and really based on this idea that we want a bottom-up movement and really make it possible have 1,000 flowers bloom. We want 1,000 co-ops to bloom. And so we work with people who have an idea. They've got some other people on board, and we work with them over a few months to take that idea and make it into reality. So that anybody can say, you know, with just their time and their effort, they've got an idea and actually run with it and create a business that is a worker-owned cooperative. And that's something that we really love. We've been developing it over time. It's called the Co-op Academy. And in just the past, say, 2 to 3 years, in talking with other groups, we've seen it expand, not just from the work that we do in the Bronx, but now folks out in Austin, Texas, with Cooperation Texas, had taken on that approach. Worcester Roots Project in Massachusetts, and Worcester, Massachusetts, have taken on that approach. Center for Workplace Democracy in Chicago has taken on that kind of an approach. And others, the Restaurant Opportunity Center, has taken on that approach with food industries, food co-ops, food worker co-ops. So there's a great effort that's happening, and it's all a part of this movement. Thank you. I got an extra minute there, or it was a part of me. I had a minute left. So there's a big effort that's underway, and it's part of, you know, just one part of the larger movement for creating worker cooperatives. But we at Green Worker Cooperatives, we are of the belief that anybody can start up a business, anybody can create a worker cooperative. You don't have to be connected to 3 or 4 or 5 foundations and get a whole lot of money and raise $10 million or $1 million or $100 million in order to be able to do it. If you've got an idea, then you can create an opportunity there. You know, there are people that you can go to and resources that are available, and just the people that are up here are excellent resources. The people who organized Jackson Rising are excellent resources. The U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives should be your number one place where anybody who wants to check out and create co-ops should be checking them out. So there are resources that are all around here and that are available for all of us. For those of you who are part of different social justice organizations, and you are connected and you want to be out here and you want to see this, take this model back to your cities and back to the communities where you're from. You know, there's resources wherever you are in any part of the country. And if you're not really sure where, then just grab somebody next to you and say, who do I talk to? You know, grab anybody up here and ask, who do I talk to? But there are resources that are out there, and all of us here want to build more worker cooperatives and create it possible so that it's the people who actually need it and who actually want to make it happen and turn their own communities around that can really be at the lead, at the forefront, and creating a movement that's about putting people first and not putting corporations and the wealthy first. Thank you.
I'm Mike Bell. I'm the CEO of the National Cooperative Business Association. I bring you the greetings of all of the cooperative movements and the sectors. And our organization attempts to bring all of the sectors together, really focusing on cooperation among cooperatives. I want to thank the Federation of Southern Co-ops. Ralph Page, Cornelius Blanding are on our board, so I want to give a tip of the hat to them. I want to thank them for all they've done here. Let's give them a round of applause. Federation of Southern Cooperatives. You know, when you talk about all of the folks that, you know, when Jackson is working towards all of the cooperatives that you want to build, I want to talk to you just a minute about all of the cooperatives you'll join. The more than 2 million people who own their own grocery stores in the food co-op sector. They get their fresh, local, organic foods from local farmers. The more than 50 million people, 50 million, that cover 70% of the country, that get their electricity from electric cooperatives. The millions of farmers who are owners of brands we all know, like Cabot Creamery, Ocean Spray, Organic Valley, Land O'Lakes, Blue Diamond. Names that you know and may not have known are cooperatives. You're joining them. You're also joining local store owners who come together in purchasing cooperatives, like True Value Hardware and Ace Hardware. Those are cooperatives of small businesses that work together to bring all of the pieces into the store through a cooperative. Also, the millions of people living in housing cooperatives. Omar's just talked about all of the worker co-op folks. And also, from the sector that I have come from, credit unions. Credit unions are about to break 100 million members in this country, and there is $1 trillion in savings in credit unions. That is the cooperative family that Jackson is seeking to join with this conference. So I bring you the welcome of all of those cooperators. So we love you for what you're doing here. We welcome you into the cooperative movement as you work, and we stand ready to help and to assist you with everything that you may need. So the rest of my time here, I just want to give a little bit of advice, remarks. The Federation of Southern Co-ops and NCBA stand ready to assist with technical assistance and partnership. We want to see you bring together urban and rural here. Do not separate it, connect it. Embrace the other co-op sectors I talked about. In the session I sat in this morning, there was really some disconnect to electric co-ops, to credit unions. Don't forget about them. If you can't get them doing what you need them to do, you should talk to us. We will help you. So embrace those other sectors as you go. You know, I want to talk to you that I think you need to instill, you know, in your co-ops as you're building them, the concepts that you are forming businesses. They are meant to be sustained. They are meant to be profitable. They're not meant to be charities. This work about sustainability is an important point not to lose. And as you go forward, spend time working at that so that you have co-ops now and in the future. So I also want to talk to you one bit about something that you can do more to talk about co-ops with your elected officials. Do you realize that our Congress has appropriated less than $8 million a year for cooperative development? This while we spend billions and trillions of dollars in Afghanistan and Iraq, we spend trillions of dollars in support of big business, and yet we have done very little to fund cooperative development, and that needs to change. Even the Obama administration in its last two budgets has actually eliminated that $7 million in appropriation and has not asked for it. So we need to go back to both the administration and the Congress. When you're talking to your elected officials, money for cooperative development, more money to do what you're doing here, we think needs to be part of the future. I want to leave you with just the thought that as Jackson moves forward, that there is a co-op family, and that at the National Cooperative Business Association, we hope to see co-ops springing up here all over the region, all over the state, and we stand ready to work with you on, with the Federation on the new law in Mississippi. There are still states, Mississippi is not the only one, that does not have a foundational law for forming other types of cooperatives other than agriculture or credit and electric. And we think that's something that also needs to change. So I wish you well in the rest of your time here. And remember, sometimes you have to stand up and cheer that you love your co-op. Thank you very much.
Okay, my name's Michael Peck. I'm from Mondragon. That can be pronounced Mondragon or Mondragon or just Mondragon. We are the world's largest worker industrial cooperative, 80,000 worker owners, $24 billion in sales, 39 countries, with our own bank, our own insurance company, our own university, and we started 60 years ago in absolute poverty, and what we did, you can do here in Jackson Rising, Mississippi. There's one line you have to cross. In Mondragon, we own our labor and we rent our capital. Who is in favor of that? I want you to stand up. Stand up. Everybody who wants to own their labor and rent their capital. Stand up. Come on. Stand up. This is what we mean by Jackson Rising. This is what Jackson Rising means. It means owning your labor and renting your capital, and not the reverse. Thank you. So, in 2009 with the United Steelworkers, thanks to President Leo Gerard, we created something called the Union Co-op Model, which is essentially Mondragon principles, one worker, one vote, and a collective bargaining agreement. We're now active in 15 cities across the country. Kristen Barker, who I introduced to you, is going to talk to you throughout the day about what's happening in Cincinnati. But we've just started an activist organization, nonprofit, called OneWorkerOneVote.org. And what we're going to do is work with every city who wants to work with us to help establish union co-ops where workers own their business, where equal access to equal share equity, where we create family and community sustaining jobs, where we recycle profits, where we get out of the top down and we get into the bottom up, and we get our economic sovereignty back and start controlling our own barrios, our own neighborhoods, and our own cities again. If anybody doesn't like that, I want to hear it. A lot of people talk about the sharing economy. I want to talk to you about the sharing economy because Morning Joe on MSNBC, they just did a segment with the editor of Wired magazine. And all the people on the show were sort of cha-cha-chaing about the new trust-based economy. You know, you've heard of companies like Airbnb, and how risky it is to share your homes with strangers. the irony that people that don't trust traditional institutions like big banks all of a sudden opening their houses to strangers, and they're saying, isn't this great? Isn't the internet great? All of a sudden the internet is helping us to trust each other like we've never trusted anybody before. I think that's a bunch of BS. I think about Amazon warehouse workers who are minimum wagers. I think about Walmart workers who are minimum wagers. I think about McDonald's workers who are minimum wages. I think about these companies that advertise how their workers can get food stamps on their website because they're too cheap to pay a living and sustaining wage. The sharing economy provides platforms for people to squeeze a few extra dollars to help with the bills. The real driver here is desperation. It's not trust. We're sharing our belongings. Actually, we're offering short-term rentals on them because we have no other way out. The gig economy, going from one gig to the next, is based on short-term deals that have constantly to be replaced. It's exhausting, it can be demeaning, and it puts a downward pressure on wages. Everybody has a phone, everybody has a smartphone. Apple makes those phones overseas. They don't want to pay US taxes. The sharing economy doesn't just efficiently exploit our possessions, it ruthlessly exploits our labor. Jackson, Mississippi has to be different than that. We've got to create businesses where the workers own the company, where the workers get to decide who their bosses are, where the workers get to fire their bosses if their bosses aren't competent, where the workers get to decide who, what, where, when, how, and we can do it starting with this conference and starting working with us. If you want to work with us, I promise you, we want to work with you. So thank you, Jackson.
Well, good afternoon, Jackson, Tennessee. Mississippi. I'm from Tennessee. I'm just so nervous. Please forgive me. I have been afforded the opportunity to speak all over the country, but never have I felt so honored and so proud to be here speaking to all of you, because all of you are my people. I feel so proud to be here today because only a couple of hundred miles from here, a few years ago, I picked cotton. I was part of another cooperative. It wasn't my cooperative. It was called sharecropping. Today, I am so proud and honored to be a worker and a owner of New Era Window Company in Chicago, Illinois. We have been open exactly 1 year now, and we're very proud because we are actually competing against companies that have been making windows for 35, 40 years, and we're taking their customers. So we must be doing something right. Back in 2008, our bosses walked away from our jobs. But we didn't walk away from our jobs. And I feel that the cooperative movement is a way to give people back their lives. For me, working is more than just a paycheck. Working is who I am. It's how I pay my bills. It's how I feed my kids, my grandkids. When I get up in the morning and I have a job to go to, there's a feeling that I can't explain. And I feel very honored and proud because this wasn't an opportunity that someone gave me, but this was an opportunity that I helped to make myself. I look around the room and I talk to so many people. And I see so many faces, and it is just fantastic. The United States used to be known as the country that made things, you know, made in the United States. Now all you see is made in Japan, made in Korea. But I feel that the cooperative movement is going to give us our second win. And again, we will be known as the country that make things. Right now, we're making cooperatives. We're making jobs. We're making futures. And I would just like to say again that thank you so much, Jackson. To get here yesterday, it was really a trip for me. I mean, it took me like 12 hours just to get a plane to get here. But I was determined to be here today, and I just want to thank everyone for having me be here. Thank you so much. And I bring tidings from New Air Window Cooperative in Chicago, Illinois.
Good afternoon. I want to first say that as a member of the Black Workers for Justice, the Southern Workers Assembly, and the Black Left Unity Network, that we're very, very glad to be here and recognize the importance of this Jackson Rising's New Economies Conference. The very name of the conference implies or either states directly that there's a growing dissatisfaction with the capitalist economy. And I think we have to keep this in mind as we talk about cooperatives. We know that the insatiable drive for profits over human needs, rights of the people, and the protection of the planet has deeply impoverished many of in the working class and some in the middle class, with the deepest social, economic, and environmental impacts of working class Black and other people of color and communities. We were attracted to come to this conference for a few reasons. One, that it is held in the South, a region playing a particular strategic role in the U.S. and global economy, that is held in the state of Mississippi, and particularly in the city of Jackson, and because it emerges out of a program that's seeking democratic people's governance in a solidarity economy, which included the election of Chokwe Lumumba and a new battlefront in the struggle to alter the balance of power in favor of working and oppressed people in the midst of this economic crisis, which has to be a strategic goal of those of us who are talking about transforming society. We know that this system is not going to be turned upside down this summer, but we have to move to build strategic power that positions us to wage a real struggle against a system that's unraveling, and all it needs is a conscious and organized push that begins to prefigure the kind of society that we want to build and that we need to have if we really, really want human rights. Mississippi, a state in a region with a brutal history of racist, economic, and political oppression, underdevelopment, and divisions among the working class, and where the struggle for democracy was most profound, people are beginning to understand that without working class and people's power, that democracy never fully develops and is always threatened by the interests and the power of the 1%. So when we talk about cooperatives, we have to talk about struggling to more fully develop democracy and struggling to more fully empower working people, both within and on the fringes of the capitalist economy, so that our movement is not just based on protest in city, but is based on some real contention with the forces who oppress, exploit, and dominate our lives. I'm an international rep with almost 25 years in the United Electrical Workers Union. I'm honored to have been on a part of the campaign to organize the Windows and Doors plant when we thought we were organizing in a stable economy, and was proud of the union that gave direction that plant and that equipment belongs to the workers whose very labor created the wealth that's reflected in the plant and the equipment, so they took control of the plant. We believe that a part of the cooperative movement has to follow this orientation as well and be a force that not only represents a new business model, but a force that's contending with the forces of capital and the direction that capital is taking. When these plants indicate that they're going to close and go offshore, then workers should be seizing control of those plants and this equipment and turn them into cooperatives. All of these empty plants in our communities, where our people drive by every day and cry because they saw the places that they created millions and millions of profit for shut down, leaving them to suffer, they have to understand that those plants belong to them, and that we should be seizing those plants and calling on local and state government to put up money to help to finance those plants as cooperatives owned by the people. Our orientation about cooperatives has to be part of a larger movement. The labor movement, the unemployed, all of these together must be identified as the forces to build a solidarity economy. If not, we will look at cooperatives as the exclusive base for a solidarity economy and will find them isolated and not have any power really to directly contend with capital. So I think these are some of the things that we have to think about as we think about cooperatives. Because the high rate of unemployment is really not going to allow our people to come up with the initial seed money all the time to begin to form these organizations. Therefore, we have to have power to extract resources from the existing economy so that we can help to support a transitional and transformative direction, which we believe is how we look at the cooperative models. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Jackson. I'm Mary B. McMillan with the North Carolina AFL-CIO, and I am glad to be here, and I'm glad to bring some gender diversity to this panel. Since I'm from the AFL-CIO, I come at building worker wealth and power through traditional union organizing. This panel is supposed to be about national lessons. Well, I think there's a lesson that national labor leaders need to learn, and I think it's also important for the co-op movement, and it is this. If we want economic justice throughout this nation, if we want to create a new economy, we must do it first in the South. For labor, it is organize the South or die. So I want to talk about why it's so important that Jackson is rising and that workers around the South are rising up. And I want to start with a story that illustrates how ignoring the South has come at great expense to labor. I first got involved in the labor movement when Saladin and UE150 were organizing service workers at NC State University. I volunteered to help with that campaign, and I spent my time talking to housekeepers on campus. I heard how afraid they were to enter dark buildings on campus at 5 a.m. I heard how with downsizing, they now had to clean twice as many buildings in the same amount of time. And I heard how they worked 40 back-breaking hours on campus and then went to work in a fast food restaurant, rarely seeing their kids, but doing what they had to make ends meet. Those women are why I'm in the labor movement. Those women are why I want so desperately to change the fact that North Carolina is one of only two states that make it completely illegal for public employees to collectively bargain. Those women were on my mind a lot in 2011 when the governor of Wisconsin launched his attack on public sector collective bargaining. I thought about those housekeepers as I watched people flood the Wisconsin Capitol in outrage, as I watched the labor movement around the country rally in support of the Wisconsin workers. I thought about those housekeepers because as public employees in North Carolina, they had never had the right to collectively bargain. I think about them and I wonder, where is the outrage over their lack of rights? I think about them and I wonder, what if decades ago the labor movement had rallied in support of bargaining rights in North Carolina? If that had happened, maybe the lives of those housekeepers would be better. Maybe we wouldn't have to rally in Wisconsin or now fight right to work in Ohio and Missouri. But that didn't happen. Labor didn't rally together to fight the laws of the South. And so now we see the suffering and exploitation of the South spreading like a cancer around the country. Our low wages drive down wages everywhere. Our Tea Party conservatives block legislation in Congress. And thanks to ALEC, our union-busting laws are spreading like wildfire. What happens in the South affects the nation, and that effect will only increase as the South grows in population and political influence. So what does that mean for workers? Is our future one of even more exploitation, or is there a brighter future? When I look at this room and I hear what's being discussed at this conference, I know that workers have a much brighter future. I know that together we can build a movement that will change the South, and by doing so, we will change this nation. I know that because when I reflect on what's happening here and around the South, I'm reminded of the words of A. Philip Randolph, who opened the March on Washington saying, "Let the nation and world know the meaning of our numbers. We are not a pressure group. We are not an organization or groups of organizations. We are not a mob. We are the advance guard of a massive moral revolution for jobs and freedom. And if ever we needed a moral revolution, it is now, brothers and sisters. We're at a crossroads. Are we going to just keep talking about inequality? Or are we going to do something about it? Are we going to keep bemoaning the decline in union membership and doing the same things we always do? Or are we going to do things differently and organize workers in ways we never thought of, in places we never dreamed about? If it's justice we seek, the only way there is through the South. Civil rights leaders understood that. That's why Dr. King marched with sanitation workers in Memphis. It's why college students sat down at a lunch counter in Greensboro. Civil rights leaders understood that if they could change policies in the heart of Jim Crow, then they could change laws nationally, and they did. So for us, if we want economic justice throughout this nation, We must wage the battle where it is most difficult for working people. And brothers and sisters, it's no surprise that yet again, that's here in the South. I was struck recently by a story told to me by an organizer on the Fast Food Workers Campaign. He talked about going into a Burger King in North Carolina, and the worker there told him, "I've been following the fast food actions and strikes on TV." And she said to him, "Where have you been? I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you. There are thousands upon thousands of workers just like her all around the South. Workers who want their fair share, who are ready to organize, but who are waiting, waiting and wondering, where is the union? Where is the co-op? Those workers can't wait. Justice can't wait. So brothers and sisters, what are we waiting for? This conference has lit a spark. It is up to us to fan the fire of justice. And if we don't take advantage of this, brothers and sisters, shame on us. Shame on us because the other side knows the power we have. The Chamber of Commerce, they're saying that if labor organizes the South, it will cause, quote, serious political upheaval. If they know the power we have, we should know the meaning of our numbers. Brothers and sisters, if we get union members together with the NAACP, together with people of faith, if we unite black, white, and brown, young and old, men and women, if we organize workers from Virginia to Texas around a message of hope, not fear, we will create more than just serious political upheaval. We will create a massive moral revolution that will bring jobs and freedom to every corner of this nation. So if you're ready for political upheaval, if you're ready for a little revolution, let's organize the South, brothers and sisters. The time is now, the place is here, and the power is ours. So don't let workers wait a minute longer. Help us organize the South. And if anybody asks you why we should organize the South, tell them. We should organize because there's too much corporate greed and we have families to feed. There are so few jobs, no decent wages. Inequality tops the news pages. CEOs earn more and more while the rest of us grow poor. The bosses want their workers cheap, meek and docile like sheep. They move their companies south, hoping we won't give them any mouth. Well, imagine their surprise as they watch the South arise. From the mountains to the sea, black, white, and brown agree. Now is the time to take a stand for justice throughout this land. That's why we'll organize every workplace, every town. And there'll be no stopping us, no backing down. In the face of our unity, injustice will crumble, it will crack, and victory will be ours. Forward together, not one step back.